Last week I ended expanding Romans 9. If you'd like to turn with me to Romans 9, I was talking at that particular time about the Creator and the world. And I quoted Romans 9 and then went to certain other scriptures concerning it and what it actually had to say, because before dealing with the Creator and the world, I'd been talking about the potter and the clay, and how we are in fact just clay. That's all we are. I mean, we are formed of the dirt of the earth. We're just the same as Adam was. He was made of the clay. He was made of the ground. And the very word ground is a dharma. It's linked to the word Adam. Adam, in other words, dirt you are and to dirt you shall return. Well, you know, when it's almost like God called to Adam, he said, dirt, come here, you know. And that's really what he's saying. The ground that we were taken from, we're very much part of. But here in Romans chapter 9 and in verse 14, it says, what shall we say then? Is there unrighteousness with God? Is God going to be unrighteous? I mean, he makes the rules. He actually defines what righteousness is and what it is not. So how can he be unrighteousness? And as Paul says, he says, God forbid. For he says to Moses, I'll have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. Now, if we want to actually find out where that was actually mentioned, if we get a marker or something and actually put the markers in here in Romans 9, and we turn back to Exodus 33, we can actually see where this is actually mentioned in Exodus 33, in verse 12. So Exodus 33, verse 12, it says, and Moses said to the Eternal, see, you say unto me, bring up this people, and you have not let me know whom you'll send with me. In other words, you said, okay, you've told me to go ahead and bring these people up out of the land of Egypt. But who's going to come and accompany me and actually help me with this task? Yet you said, I know you by name, and you've also found grace in my sight. Now therefore I pray you, if I found grace in your sight, show me now your way, that I may know you, that I may find grace in your sight, and consider that this nation is your people. In other words, make sure I get this straight. It is you, Eternal, who is actually taking the nation of Israel out of the land of Egypt. It is you that is actually delivering and taking them into the promised land. And he's saying, look, let me understand this. Let me get my mind around this. And again, Moses was exceedingly meek, it says, teachable, and the most meek man of all the earth. And here you can see his approach as far as God was concerned, the one that became Jesus Christ, how, in fact, this was the case. It was a very teachable attitude that he had. And he said, my presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest. In other words, God himself is going to go ahead and give him the rest that's necessary. And he said unto him, if your presence does not go with me, then don't take us up from here. In other words, it's not something that I can do myself. He had the humility to be able to see that it wasn't something that he could actually accomplish. For wherein shall it be known here that I and your people have found grace in your sight? Is it not that you go with us? So shall we be separated, I and your people, from all the people that are upon the face of the earth. And this is an important point. You see, here is Moses actually talking to God. And remember, we look back in Romans 9. He says, what shall we say? Is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. For he said to Moses, I'll have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. We're coming on to that bit. But this is the context of that. I'll have mercy and compassion. It was Moses saying, look, I need mercy and compassion on me, Moses, in other words, because He wasn't capable of actually taking the entire nation of God himself into the promised land. So shall we be separated, I and your people, from all the people that are upon the face of the earth. And the Eternal said to Moses, I will do this thing also that you have spoken. For you have found grace in my sight, and I know you by name. God knew Moses inside and out. Moses understood this and needed to have that reassurance at that particular time. And he said, I beseech you, show me your glory. You know, he was asking to really make an impression as far as he was concerned. He said, I'll make all my goodness pass before you, and I'll proclaim my name of the Eternal before you. And I'll be gracious to whom I'll be gracious, and I'll show mercy on whom I'll show mercy. There's the quote that's actually being taken from. And he said, you shall not see my face, for no man shall see me and live. And the Eternal said, Behold, there's a place by me, and you shall be standing upon a rock. It shall come to pass that when my glory passes by, that I'll put you in the cleft in the rock, cover you with a hand as I pass by, and I'll take away my hand, and you'll see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. And if you remember, that is actually what happened. He was in this cleft of the rock, he was wedged in the rock, and Christ came past, declaring his righteousness, which was really his glory, and shaded Moses as he went past, and he didn't see his face at all, and yet he came down from that mountain with his face glowing. And in fact, you know, scared everybody that he came in contact with, because his face was glowing after being in the presence of God. But as he says here, this is where this is being actually taken from. So when we're looking at Romans 9, and it says here, For he said to Moses, I will have mercy on whom I'll have mercy, and I'll have compassion on whom I'll have compassion. Who was it that said that? It was this being who, when a human being was hidden in a rock, was sheltered by his hand, went past so they only saw the back part of him, still came down to the mountain with his face glowing. This was the being. This is the being that you to give an impression as far as what this being is like. He's the creator of all things. He has ultimate power. This is the being that's being talked about. So it's not of him that wills or him that runs, but of God that shows mercy. It's not for mankind to determine. But this is what Moses was saying. Look, he says, don't give these people to me. We need mercy. We need mercy on him, Moses, so that he could lead the people. He had the right approach, the right attitude and frame of mind. Now, remember, we're looking at the subject of keeping the relationship accurate. Moses had the relationship accurate. He got this relationship accurate. And the fact is that I introduced the sermon last week, and this is a continuation of that sermon. Because of the question that I had over in Minnesota at the breakfast table, you know, why are there so many chapters in Job? What's so special about Job? And I said, had to say, I don't know. I don't know, because I really don't know for sure. But I know this much, that it is keeping that relationship accurate, which Job wasn't doing. He got out of kilter. He got himself as the centre instead of God as the centre. And here in Romans 9, he talks about Moses having mercy on whom I'll have mercy. And it's only by going back and seeing, well, what's the context of that passage, that you see that, no, it's in fact getting this relationship right was all the subject matter being discussed at the time that quotation was given. So it's not of him that wills or of him that runs, not the ones that are being sent, not the apostles, it's not the prophets, not the ministers, not the servants, not the members, but of God that shows mercy. You know, no man can come unto me unless the Father that sends me draws him. God's got to draw. It's God that shows mercy. God that shows mercy. And for the scripture said to Pharaoh, even of this same purpose have I raised you up, that I might show my power in you, and that my name, it goes on, it says, be declared throughout all the earth. Therefore he has mercy on whom he'll have mercy, and on whom he will he hardens. Not only does he show mercy in a certain direction, he'll also harden in a certain direction for an overall plan and purpose. Why? Because he's God. Is he unrighteous? Is this unrighteous? He says, God forbid. Would say, is there unrighteousness with God? God forbid. It's still going in the same basic direction, which is a way of love, a way of outgoing concern, a way that is righteous. Therefore, he'll have mercy on whom he'll have mercy, and whom he will he hardens. You say then to him, why does he yet find fault? For who's resisted his will? But nay, O man, who are you that replies against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that forms it, why have you made me thus? Is that what, in fact, the case is? Has not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel to honour and another to dishonour? So if you remember, again, keep your marker in here. Let's turn back to Isaiah 45. Isaiah 45. We read this last time as well. And just remind ourselves what this particular passage tells us. Because, you know, what's the subject matter here? It says, do you say, will you then find fault, or will you, who is resisting his will? Are you arguing? Shall the thing that formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me thus? Well, that's being taken from this passage here in Isaiah 45, where it's, or the concept certainly is. And here in verse 9 it says, woe unto him that strives with his maker. It actually has a confrontation with his maker. And this, unfortunately, was the problem with Job. He had a confrontation with his maker. The relationship was not accurate at that time. He maintained his righteousness. And he was righteous on the surface. But he was self-righteousness. He was there. And that self-righteousness would not be valid as far as the relationship necessary for him to become a son of God. For him to become a born son of God, which he was actually being worked with by this being. So woe unto him that strives with his maker. Let the potsherds strive with the potsherds of the earth. Let the Adams strive with the Adamas of the earth. The potsherds being the broken pots, the clay that's been broken. Let one piece of broken pottery strive with another piece of broken pottery, because that's all we are. We're clay. Shall the clay say to him that fashions it, what are you making? Or to his do your work? He has no hands. He doesn't know what he's doing. Woe to him that says to his father, why do you beget me? What are you begetting? Or to the woman, what have you brought forth? So, and notice it says, thus says the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel and his Maker, ask me of things to come. Concerning my sons and concerning the work of my hands command you me. I've made the earth and created man. And it's his sons. We are the sons of God. To be those that he's... Ultimately, all humanity is to become the sons of God. But if that's the context, then, that you find, again, if we come back to Romans 9, it says, therefore he will have mercy on whom he'll have mercy, verse 18, and whom he will, he hardens. And you will say then unto me, does he yet find fault? For who has he resisted his will? No, but, O man, who are you that reply against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why have you made me thus? Has not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel to honour and another to dishonour? Now, this is the fact, it's a fact of life. The potter has complete control over the clay. He can literally, as he's working that clay, as he works, spins the wheel and works the clay, and he starts feeling bits of grit in it, he can crunch the whole clay up and he can put it back in the tub and pound it with his feet. He can take the grit out. He can wash it with water and put it through the, the wringer that he uses or whatever. However he is actually going to use the implements that he uses to pummel the clay and get rid of the grit. And then he can put it back on the wheel and work it again. But he has complete control. Complete control. The clay, is the clay going to say, hey, what are you doing? Why? I don't want to go back in that pot again. I don't want to go and be pummeled. Who does? But the potter is the one that knows whether the clay needs refining, whether the clay needs the grit taken out of it. And unfortunately, we don't necessarily see things quite the same way. The grit becomes very, very close at hand to us. Has not the potter power over the clay of the same lump to make one vessel to honour and another to dishonour? And it says, what if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long suffering the vessels of wrath fit for destruction? Now, as I pointed out, if you look at the fact that you have the vessels of mercy, when you're looking at it, says in verse 23, and that he may make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had before prepared for glory. So he's making this contrast between the two. The vessels of mercy are the church. Vessels of mercy are the church. Job was a vessel of mercy, actually. He didn't feel like it at that particular time, but he was. God had, the one that became Jesus Christ had a full understanding of what Job needed, and what when Job is actually in the kingdom of God in the future, and he'll look back on his time on this earth. Will he even look back on the time? It says it won't even be brought to mind ultimately. It won't even be remembered. It'll be remembered as much as we remember being in the womb. How much do we even remember being in the womb? Unless we've been damaged in some way, and even then we don't have a memory of it. But Job will, for the time that he will look back, he'll look back on the time that he was going through the trials that he was going through and see how, in fact, it was worth it. And, in fact, it was a case of getting rid of the grit, getting rid of the muck that was there, because his own righteousness, righteousness that is centered on him, is not good enough. It's not going to actually do the job. It's not going to accomplish the job that's necessary if he's going to be a son of God. What if God, willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much long-suffering the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction, and that he may make known the riches of his glory, or the vessels of mercy which he did alone prepared for his glory, even us, notice, even us, whom he has called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. Now, those that are actually called, it says, no man can come to me unless the Father that sends me draws him, and I'll raise him up the last day. These are the ones which will be there in the first resurrection. And it's important to remember that. It's not just a case that those that the Father calls, but I'll raise him up on the last day. And it's a case of these are the first fruits. These are the ones that are going to be the sons of God initially for a great purpose. As we mentioned last week, Job had hundreds probably die in his education, for his education. His servants died by probably the hundreds. When you come to David, it was 70,000 actually died. 70,000, because he was not to go ahead and number Israel, and he was given a choice, okay? And this choice was given by Christ. What are you going to take? Famine, or are you going to take a pestilence, or are you going to take being subject to your enemies? And he said, look, let me take something from the Eternal. And he therefore took pestilence. And 70,000 of people died because of his sin. Because God needed, and Christ needed, to get across a lesson to David. And the fact that 70,000 died, 70,000 were the vessels of wrath, long-suffering, and vessels of wrath fitted for destruction. God allowed those to die. He allowed them to die, knowing that they will eventually be raised up in the great white throne judgment. But he allowed them to die. But the ones that he didn't allow to die, the ones, the vessels of mercy, even though he treated Job, gave Job into the hands of Satan, allowed Satan to actually be instrumental, who couldn't see his problem, who could not see his problem, because Satan is self-centered himself. Therefore, the fact that Job was righteous, he was just looking at what he was doing. He wasn't looking at the fact of why he was doing it. He was doing it because of his righteousness, because of the sense of self-centeredness. But that he may know the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he has afore prepared to glory, even us, who he has called, not only of the Jews, but also of the Gentiles as well. And as he said in Hosea, I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. That's the focus. That's the focus. So keeping that relationship accurate, yes, we see the Creator dealing with the world, dealing with the nations of the world, allowing people to die if necessary. And he's perfectly entitled to do that. He's the Creator. He's the one that's fulfilling his greater purpose. But he's also dealing with the church. He's also having a hand on us. And this section in Hosea, if you turn with, again, keep a marker over here in Romans 9, and turn back to Hosea 1. Hosea 1, first of the minor prophets. Hosea 1, it says in verse 10, it says, yet the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. And then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel, the two together, be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Now Jezreel is up in the north, It's the Armageddon. Armageddon is the hill that overlooks the Vale of Jezreel, the Valley of Jezreel. Jezreel is this huge flat area where the troops will actually gather to come down against Christ when he actually returns. So the children of Judah and the children of Israel will be gathered together, but they will be gathered together at this place where they said, "You're not my people." Now, if you want to, again, keep your hand in Hosea as well. You run out of fingers soon. But turn back to Joshua. Joshua, well, I've pointed this out many times before, but for those that perhaps haven't heard it before, it's worth reiterating again. Joshua chapter 7, verse 1, it says, "But the children of Israel committed a trespass in the accursed thing, for Achan, the son of Carmi, and of the tribe of Judah, took of this accursed thing, and the anger of the Eternal was kindled against the children of Israel." Now, the anger of the Eternal came to the point, and remember who this Eternal was. This is Jesus Christ dealing with the nation of Israel now. But the anger of the Eternal was to the point, as it says in verse 12, it says, "Therefore the children of Israel could not stand before their enemies, but turned their backs before their enemies, because they were accursed. Neither will I be with you any more." In other words, saying, "You are not my people." That's where it literally is. God, the one that Jesus Christ, became Jesus Christ, said to Israel, "You're not my people unless you destroy the accursed from among you." And then they drew lots, and they actually found it, and it came to Achan. He admitted it, and he had this silver and a wedge of gold of 50 shekels, and he coveted them, hid them in his tent, and he and his entire family was wiped out. And Joshua said, verse 25 now, Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Eternal shall trouble you this day." And all Israel stoned him with stone and burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. And they raised up over him a great heap of stones to this day. So the Eternal turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place was called the Valley of Achor to this day. So it was in the Valley of Achor that he says, not a people, that in fact is going to be say, you go back to Hosea again, verse 10. It says that in the place where it was said unto them, "You are not my people," there it shall be said to them, "You are the sons of a living God." So there's two things going on in this particular passage. One is, as it says, "Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head." And the Valley of Jezreel, the Valley of Armageddon, and the gathering place of Armageddon, and then they'll fight against Christ down in the Kidron Valley, will flow with blood, which is just by Jerusalem. All around that time, and again, in Jezreel, Jehu, it says in verse 4, Jehu went ahead and caused the kingdom, there's an awful lot of history that's in here as well. It's not just the looking forward in time. It's looking back into what Jehu had to do with Ahab and his entire family that was wiped out by Jehu in this area of Jezreel. It says, if you look in verse 14, it says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness." Now, the Valley of Achor is in fact just beside the Jordan. It's probably around about the place of the Allenby Bridge. But Hosea chapter 2 now, verse 14. "Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak comfortably to her. And I will give her a vineyard from there and a valley of Achor for a door of hope. And she'll sing there as in the day of her youth and in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt." And again, you're looking at these two sides of the story, one of which is the spiritual Israel, who he's talking about here, and the other one is physical Israel, which is about to come into the land. "And it shall be in that day that the Eternal, says the Eternal, that you shall call me Ishi, that's my husband, and call me no more Bali, that's my Lord." In other words, the marriage will have taken place, or will take place, and this is the indication that it may be, if there's a place on the earth that this take place, that it actually takes place. It looks as if it's this Valley of Achor, if there is an area that is specifically taking place, because there they're going to be called the sons of the living God. And as he goes on and says, it will come to pass in that day, the earth, verse 22, the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel. Now the word Jezreel is the Eternal will sow. That's what it literally means. And I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them that were not my people, you are my people, and they shall say, you are my God. So that physical Israel, you are my people, and to spiritual Israel, you are the sons of the living God. Both being said at the Valley of Achor, this Valley of Hope, which is the Valley of Contention, because the Achor was in fact the contention that actually occurred between God and Achor, and how Christ actually caused Israel to no longer be the people unless they took care of the problem at that particular place. So when we go back to Romans 9 now, it says in Hosea, I will call them my people which were not my people, and her beloved that was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place wherein it was said to them, you are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. So this is the relationship that actually is going to be there. So when I'm talking about keeping the relationship accurate, it's not just a case that God is so high above us as a potter, working on the clay, and we're mere clay and getting banged about so much. It's also the fact that he is working on his sons. The fact that he's creating this clay into his sons. And this is the other half of the equation that needs to be understood. So, looking at the subject, why so many chapters in Job? It is indeed to keep that relationship accurate. Is such an important point that we can see all the various ramifications from the three friends. What the three friends had to say, how they were accurate in so many things that they had to say, but it didn't apply in Job's case. The problem with Job is the relationship was not accurate. It was the fact that he let the center shift. And it is such a vital point that if we are going to go ahead and be these individuals, it says the vessels of mercy which he before prepared to glory, even us, to whom he has called, if we are to remain that way, there is no way. If we don't get that relationship accurate, we can't remain as the children of God. That's how serious this subject is. We've got to maintain that relationship. Turn with me, therefore, to Job 38, because there's two points I want to basically cover today. What we never forget, what we must never forget, and also what Job must never forget as well. And secondly, the Creator in dealing with the church. But here in Job, let's turn over to chapter 38. And we find the Eternal, that's the one that became Jesus Christ, answering Job out of the whirlwind. Now Elihu had actually been talking to Job and been given the essence of what the problem was with Job. But then God himself, the Eternal himself, then dealt with Job and talked to him out of the whirlwind. Said, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. This is Job 38, verse 3 now. Gird up your loins like a man, for I'll demand of you and answer you me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare, if you have understanding. Now, we might think this, the foundations of the earth, you know, when God first laid the foundations of the earth. Well, what was that time? What was the actual moment of time? When was the earth foundation first laid? Do we know? The question, the answer is we don't. We know a little bit about the fact that all the bodies are going and flying out from each other, but as to when that time was and what actually occurred, we don't. Who has laid the measure thereof, if you know? Or who has stretched the line upon it? Where are the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. When the angelic realm shouted for joy, when the creation of the world and the universe all came into being simultaneously. Where were you? Where were you? Where was I? And yet this being that is dealing with Job now, was there, and his word
caused it all to come into being,
come to exist? Who shut up the sea with the doors when it break forth as it issued from the womb? When I made the cloud the garment thereof, and thick darkness a swaddling band for it, and broke up all my decreed places, and set bars and doors, and said, Hitherto shall you come, but no further, and here shall your proud waves be stayed. Have you commanded the morning since your days, and caused the dayspring to know his place? Have we done that? So where were we? Where were you? Where was I? When the foundations of the earth were actually laid. Now, I've given this example before, because you see, when we're looking at what Job and we also must never forget, is the enormity of the one that deals with us. It is the enormity of the one that deals with us. This individual that was dealing with us as the potter that we're dealing with clay, and that's all we are, is clay. He is the one that created all things. Now, the foundation of the world, of the earth, declare if you have understanding, it goes much, much deeper than just, you know, when this was created. He just said the word and hocus pocus, it just came into being. No. There's much more to it than that. If you get what is the earth? Well, it's molecules of whatever. You know, hydrogen, iron, carbon, molecules. Well, what's a molecule? A molecule is an atom. Okay, what's an atom? Ah, well, then you start going down a bit more. And these are words that we use. But when you look at the gap or the slit experiment, which I've mentioned before again, but just think about it for a minute. You get an atom, so something that is real, little bit of something that is real, an atom. A photon, who is a piece of light, a piece of light now, because the light is streaming in from through the window at the moment, but you get one photon, or an electron. You know, what exactly are they? Well, we're not really sure, but you get one of these, and you can literally get it down to one, and you fire it at one slit, and you put something in the back of it, you get a pattern of something going solid going through the slit. You get a line of that on that slit on the other side. If you put two slits and you fire one, say one atom or one photon or one electron or one something that's solid, something that's real, something that, laid the foundation of the earth. This is the foundation of the earth. This is what we understand for be the foundation of the earth, the atoms and molecules and so on that are actually making up the earth. And this is what Job was being confronted with, the modern Job. Is being confronted with you and me, being confronted with. So you fire these balls of matter, whatever they might happen to be, photons, electrons, atoms, whatever they happen to be, and you fire it at two slits. You'd think that if the ball would go through one of the two slits, and it would form two lines on the other side. Well, that would be what happens if it was a ball, but it doesn't. And I'm not talking about firing them, whether you fire it one after another in rapid succession, or whether you fire one and then another one, and then another one, then another one, and each one going through in one slit or the other slit, you'd have thought forms these two lines, but it doesn't. What actually happens is it forms multiple lines across, and you think, well, why is that? How does that work? Well, basically, if you have a wave. If you have a wave that radiates out from each of the slits, you'd get an interference. One wave would cancel another wave out. The wave on the left-hand slit would cancel the wave of the right-hand slit out. And in another place, it would magnify it. It would actually make it come up. Can you imagine two waves rippling out from two slits and how they form a crisscross pattern? And that's what you see on the back plate. But hang on a minute, you're firing, and as I say, they've reduced it down to firing one particle through, and then you fire another particle through, and then another particle through, with time between them. And you say, well, it's going through, how can one particle go through two slits at the same time? It's impossible, you can't do that. So what they do is they put a test to see which of the slits the balls are going through. Be it an atom, be it a photon, be it an electron,
these balls of what is real, as it says, the foundations of the earth. And the moment that you start looking at it, it starts behaving the way we'd think it behave, and two lines suddenly appear on the back. The moment you stop looking at it, the interference pattern comes back again. It's almost as if there is a wave theory. The foundation of what we've got here is a wave of some description that only changes to something that is real, that you can actually touch and look at when you're looking at it. If you think of a computer game, and what happens in a computer game? Well, you're on there and you're going through this maze and you're zapping these baddies and you're doing all this in this maze. And as you turn, so the screen changes and you get all these different rooms that you go through and you collect all the coins and you do all the various things that you're doing on the computer game. What's happened to the other rooms that you've just been going through? Well, they are on the hard disk. They're noughts and ones just floating on the hard disk. They don't exist until you start looking at them. Is this something like it? Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if you have understanding. Anybody going to give an honest opinion on that? I don't know. I just don't know. All I know is that you've got these two slits and it behaves as a wave unless you're looking at it, and therefore it becomes solid. But is that what it is? And yet we live in it. We are it. And we haven't a clue what it is. We haven't a clue. Not the slightest, foggiest idea. And neither did Job, the greatest builder of his day, had not the foggiest clue as far as God is concerned. But this being that was dealing with Job made it and sustains it. His word is there, still sustaining it. And it goes beyond that. I mean, here, this is just the stuff. As I say, you can do this slit experiment, apparently, with an atom, with a photon that has no mass, but it's a particle, or an electron, or whether you probably do it with a molecule, with a lump of matter, at the quantum level. And at that quantum level, strange things happen. Strange things happen. But you know, where were we when God made this? When Christ actually issued the word and caused this to come into being, defined it, set it so that, you know, thousands of years later, millions of years later probably, billions of years later probably, people do this slit experiment and find this information. But he goes beyond that, as I said, verse 17. Have the gates of death been opened to you? Or have you seen the doors of the shadow of death? Verse 19. Where is the way that light dwells, and for darkness, where's the place thereof? Do we understand what light is? As I say, you look at the photon. It's got no mass. It's a particle. But it acts as a wave. Unless you're looking at it, and then it becomes a particle again. It's just ridiculous. We can't get our heads around it. But as I say, have the gates of death been opened to you? Do you really understand death? How does the spirit in man work? Tell me if you know, because I don't know. How does the spirit in man be breathed by a physical creature? A physical creature now breathing spirit. How does it work? How does it interface? Where is the interface between the spirit in man and the physical human being? Where is the interface? How does it fit together? Do you know? Do I know? No, I don't. I don't. And this is what's being said to Job. You see, the enormity of the one that's dealing with us. Job didn't get it. Job didn't understand. Job reckoned he did. Job reckoned he was righteous by his standard. But his centre was off. His centre had slipped. He forgot about who he was actually dealing with. And more than that, who was dealing with him? Because the one that was dealing with him was dealing with him for a purpose. He was dealing with him for a reason. 28, verse 28. Has the rain a father? Who has begotten the drops of dew? if you could do that, you would be a multi-billionaire. A multi-billionaire. If you could say, right, it's going to rain on this place and it's not going to rain on the other place, God can do that. But can we? Can we? Can we make it rain? Can we stop it from raining? More's the point over here.
And then 31. Can you bind the sweet influences, the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Can you bring forth Maseroth or his season, or can you guide Arcturus with his suns? Do you know the ordinance of heaven? Can you set the dominion thereof in the earth?
Do you have any control over the stars at all? You or I? Or Job? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's like saying to the child in the womb, can you put the kettle on the arga? can you go ahead and open the door? Can you go ahead and walk upstairs without being inside your mother? Can you do anything of these things? Where were you when, 15 years ago when I did such and such? Where were you? You weren't even a twinkle in your daddy's eye. That's what we're being saying, really.
That's what's literally being said to each and every one of us, is where were we? Can you influence the Pleiades? Can we loose the band of Orion?
Can we do anything? Is there anything that we can really do?
And verse 36. Who's put wisdom in the inward parts? Who's given understanding to the heart?
Well, the spirit of man has put wisdom in the inward parts, given there by God. But how, as I say, where's the interface between the spirit of man and the physical human being? How do you interface physical human being with spirit? Where is it? Is it in the brain? Whereabouts in the brain? How does the memory work? How does the capturing what we actually are and then resurrecting what we actually are, making us again, I myself and not another, as Job says. Can we do that? Do we even understand it? Can we grasp it? I can't. I can't grasp it. I can't understand how do you interface physical matter and spirit. But he's done it. This is Jesus Christ now.
He's actually done it. Chapter 39, verse 19. Have you given the horse strength? Have you closed his neck with thunder? Can you make him afraid as a grasshopper? The glory of his nostrils is terrible. He pours the valley.
Okay, but who made the horse? When you have you have horses in the field here, can you imagine having a foal, and actually it comes out, it's actually a goat. Can you imagine that? It comes out, you're thinking you're having a foal, but it comes out a goat. It's just a throwback. It's a throwback. It comes back as a goat. Well, obviously, it's absurd, ridiculous, nonsense. Who made it to come out as a foal? Who made it to come out as a goat? Who made it to come out as a cow? Who changes the DNA in such a way? And let's face it, 90-odd% of it is the same. 95%, is it? I think it's something like 70% between ourselves and a daffodil. Anything else. But who made it like that? Who determined it? Who wrote the code onto the DNA? That, you know, we're going to have a grandchild again fairly soon. What is the information on that child that makes it a child and a grandchild of ourselves, rather than a daffodil, or a rose, or a tulip, or something? What's the difference? Well, who wrote it? It's God who wrote it.
In verse 29, from then she seeks a prey, and her eyes behold afar off.
Who wrote the DNA that has the hawk's eye?
That the DNA of a horse, the DNA of a bird.
Who can actually construct an eye like that? Not only construct an eye, but construct the code that will cause the body at the right time, in the right place, to manufacture an eye, two eyes, working in synchro together, wired back into the brain in the right way, able to do it not just when the chick comes out of the egg, but then as it grows, so the eye becomes bigger, and all the focal lengths all remain the same, and then keep the replenishment of that eye? Can you imagine? That is all encoded. It's encoded within the DNA. The DNA molecule holds the actual words written there by the Logos. This is the one who made these things, the Logos, the one who became Jesus Christ. Where are you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Where were you when I did all these things? Can you do this? Can you do that? Can you do the other thing? And in chapter 40, moreover, the Eternal answered Job and said, shall he that contend with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproves God, let him answer it. And Job answered the Eternal and said, behold, I am vile. I'm clay. Adama. Dirt. That's all I am. He finally got the message. The contrast, the relationship suddenly became accurate. Because he saw what God could actually do and what he couldn't do. He saw the difference. He saw the absolute profound nature of the one that is dealing with him. And he, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I'll lay my hand on my mouth. Once I've spoken. Yes, twice, but I'll receive no further. And he goes on in verse 10. Deck yourself now with majesty and excellency. Array yourself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad your rage and wrath. Behold everyone that's proud and abase him. Look on everyone that's proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in secret. Then I will confess to you that your own right hand can save you. This is the being that's being dealt with. He is the Eternal. He is able to do these things. He's able to cast down. You know, the entire nations are a drop in the bucket compared. I mean, what's a drop in a bucket? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And he can deal with them. We are flesh. All the atheists that reckon they're so clever. What are they? They can do nothing. Absolutely nothing in comparison with this. If ever you want to go onto YouTube sometime, just put in a search for longitude. Longitude. There are three sections of seven. Three sections of seven sections, so 21 sections in all, about the film Longitude. And it's about a man called Harrison. The tower clock that Harrison completed about 1722 still tells time in Brocklesbury Park. It's been running continuously for more than 270 years, this particular clock. From its fine cabinet to its friction-free gearing, the clock reveals its maker as a master carpenter. When you think of the carpentry that's involved, you say, well, what do you mean carpentry of a clock? For example, the work runs without oil. The clock never needs lubrication because the parts that would normally call for it were carved out of lignium vitae, a tropical hardwood that exudes its own grease. So it never needs oil. Been going for the last 270 years. It says, when it came to fabricating toothed gears, it's all made out of wood. The whole thing is made out of wood. Fabricating toothed gears from oak, Harrison invented a new kind of wheel. Each of the wheels of the clock's going train resembled a child's drawing of the sun, with the lines of the wood grain radiating from the centre of the wheel to the tips of the teeth as though drawn there with a pencil and ruler. So he actually uses the grain of the wood to construct each cog. And he also uses the various pivot points. He uses lignum vitae that exudes its own grease, so it never needs any grease to work, and it's made of wood. Harrison further guaranteed the wheel teeth an enduring structure by selecting the oak from fast-growing trees, whose growth rings formed widely spaced ripples in the trunks. Such trees yielded lumber with a wide grain and a great might due to the high percentage of new wood. But elsewhere, wherever Harrison was willing to sacrifice strength for a lighter weight material, as in the central portion of the wheels, he turned to slow-growing oak. With growth rings clinging closer together, the wood looks grainier and weighs less. So his intimate knowledge of wood allowed him to actually make this clock. And Harrison teamed up with his brother James, and from 1725 to 1722, the brothers built two long case grandfather clocks. Now, most pendulums of Harrison's day expanded with heat, so they grew longer and ticked out time more slowly in hot weather. When cold, it made them contract, and they speeded up the seconds. By combining long and short strips of two different metals, brass and steel, in one pendulum, Harrison eliminated the problem. The Harrison's brothers tested the accuracy of their gridiron grasshopper clocks against the regular motion of the stars. In these late-night tests, the Harrison clocks never erred more than a single second in a whole month. In comparison, the very finest quality watches being produced anywhere in the world at that time drifted off by about 1 minute every day. Now, I say that because what you're looking at is you're looking at a craftsman, you're looking at a certain mindset, you're looking at a way of doing things. You know, he's a carpenter, for crying out loud. And if you can certainly go and watch that YouTube video, it's certainly worthwhile having a look at it. Talk about battling against the powers of the state. I mean, it really is a battle that he had from start to finish. But if you turn over to Isaiah 40. When we look at God, we look at what he made. What he's made, what he's actually constructed. When we look at the Harrison clock, we look at what he's made. We look at how it's made, how it's put together. The ingenuity that is in there. And, you know, he did actually, he won the Longitude Prize, which was £20,000, which was a fortune back then, worth several millions today, about 3 or 4 million probably. But here in Isaiah 40, verse 18, it says, to whom will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare to him? And verse 21, have you not known, have you not heard, has he not been told to you from the beginning, have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It's he that sits upon the circle of the earth, the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretches out the heavens as a curtain, that spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. And verse 25, to whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal, says the Holy One? This is the one that's made all things. This is the one that became Jesus Christ. And the one also that said, my Father is even greater than me. He said that over in John 14:28. Lift up your eyes on high and behold who has created these things, that brings out their host by number. He calls them all by names. And by the greatness of his might, for he is strong in power and not one fails. Who are you going to liken this being? This is what Job had to come to grips with. The relationship between us and God has got to be kept accurate. And it's absolutely essential that that is the case. If we turn over to Isaiah 55. It says in verse 7, let the wicked forsake his way, the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return to the Eternal. And he will have mercy upon him and unto our God, for he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. How can they be? It's like saying to a child in the womb, can you put the kettle on the stove? Can you carry these books upstairs? Can he do anything like that? Something that's absolutely dead easy for us? For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven and returns not there, but waters the earth and makes it bring forth and bud, that gives seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out of my mouth. It'll not return to me void, but will accomplish whatever I send it to do, whatever I please. It'll prosper in the thing whereunto I send it. So whatever God says, whatever he decides, that's what it is. And this relationship, and keeping this relationship accurate, is what it's all about. Now let me just read a little bit more, once again, this passage that Mr. Armstrong, or part of this passage that I read last time, from the Sermon on Why the First Fruits.
He says there's a reason why we are the first fruits, and I wish I could drive that home, but I fear that most of you just don't get it. You don't understand it at all. Why are we the first fruits? I'm going to make it plain this afternoon, and still I think you won't get it. Because so much Protestantism has rubbed off on us that we can't get it out of our heads. They think God is trying to save the whole world. Don't they? What do they actually say? Well, by evangelism, the whole world will be saved. And he's failing miserably. If you really look at it in the cold light of day, this God that they worship is failing miserably. That's nothing to do with it. That's what they say. They say that by evangelism, by personal evangelism, human evangelism. That's not the way it is at all. God's plan is on target. So much Protestantism has rubbed off on us, we can't get it out of our heads. They think God's trying to save the whole world, and then we think, well, he's just saving us first. That's not the answer at all. We're not saved just because God wants us to be his favourites and get into the kingdom ahead of us others. We're saved for a very, very great purpose. You see, it's this being that we've just been looking at, the one that the foundation of reality rests on his word. This is the being that's dealing with us. This is the being that gave us his truth, his mind. We are the first fruits of God's harvest for his kingdom. And this is what we don't seem to get. This is what we don't seem to have sink into our heads. One particular... turn over to 2 Thessalonians 2. 2 Thessalonians 2. Because somebody sent me this letter from somebody of another church group. I mentioned about this problem before, that people are saying this apostasy was nothing to do with the actual falling away that we witnessed in the church. And it wasn't until I actually had this letter that I really started to understand a little bit more about it. Let me read some of it to you. One of the most vital and neglected prophecies of all the Bible is found in 2 Thessalonians 2. After setting the stage in chapter 1 by describing Christ returning with flaming fire and taking vengeance on those who do not obey the gospel, the inspired apostle Paul warns Christians, I want you to notice that now, warns Christians, not to let anyone deceive them by teaching that Christ is coming without the most massive anti-God rebellion in human history occurring first. The Apostle Paul was inspired to write, for that day will not come unless the rebellion comes first. And the King James, it says, except there come a falling away first. But he says rebellion first. And the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that's called God or is worshipped, so that he sits in the temple of God, proclaiming himself that he is God. I've just quoted from the Revised Standard Version, as it's important for you to realize that many of the best translations indicate the word translated falling away in the King James is better translated as rebellion from the original Greek. This Greek word was in fact a military term meaning revolt or rebellion against authority. The idea that this coming total rejection of God, and I want you to notice what he says, is simply an apostasy from some teaching of some church or group of churches, is simply not indicated here. Did you catch what he's saying? What is being said there? That what actually the apostasy that we witnessed was just some teaching from some church or group of churches. What is missed, there's so many things are missed. First of all, the actual word for falling away is apostasia. Apostasia. Apostasy, in other words. It comes from apostasian, which is the divorce or bill of decree, the divorcing. The other time that it's used is in Acts 21, verse 21, where it says that, accusing Paul of forsaking Moses, of apostatizing against Moses. It's very clearly apostasia. In addition to that, notice in verse 10, with all deceivableness and righteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And in verse 12, that all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. And verse 13, "But we are bound to give thanks always to God for you, brethren, beloved of the Lord, because God has from the beginning chosen you for salvation through sanctification of the Spirit and belief of the truth."
You see, if you believe that all that we are believing about is just another religion, it's just Protestant, it's just another Protestant religion, if that's all there is to it, then you forsake the truth. And what we need to understand is that to get this relationship right, to get this relationship accurate, it's not just a case of we're clay, we're physically clay, and God is God, and we have the contrast is so huge. But this clay is being made into a son of God. And that son of God has got to understand God's truth. It is God's truth, it is God's work, it's God's plan, it's God's church. And to equate the church with just another Christian group, just another, as he says here, teaching of some church or group of churches. It's not just some church or group of churches. It is the truth. It is the truth of God. And it was apostatizing away from that truth that there's a problem. But it's so easy to take on board some kind of idea like that.
Now, we turn to 1 Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1. We find in verse 17, it says, "For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom of words, that the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. For the preaching of the cross is to them that are perishing foolishness, but to us which are being saved," and because it's a present progressive word, "it is the power of God. For it's written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent."
He's going to destroy the wisdom, all the understanding, all the ideas of men. He'll destroy that.
"Where is the wise? Where's the scribe? Where's the disputer of this world? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world?"
He points out all the religions of this world. He points to them, it's foolishness. It's crazy, Protestants included. Because they don't have the plan. They're not obedient to these holy days. They're not obedient to God's will. And therefore they don't have the plan of God. They can't see what God is doing. Now this huge difference between God and us as clay also is reflected between us as clay and what God wants to make us into. Because we are to be his sons. This is the difference, the staggering difference. The Creator with us in the church, the Creator is creating us into his image, in his likeness. Yes, he's already done that. But he's creating us into his spiritual likeness. And that is not possible physically. We can't do that ourselves. This is the huge, huge difference.
"For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe."
In other words, he pokes fun at the wisdom of man. And therefore, keeping that relationship accurate is essential for every one of us. It's essential that we recognize the divine nature of God, and we also recognize that we've got to go to him and accept that sacrifice of Christ to cover the sins, the past sins, so that we have that access to God the Father, and through the Spirit of God then are able to be converted, changed. And that conversion is not just obeying a few laws, it's not just doing a few good things, it's not just being a nice person. It is being converted into a God being. That's the difference. And we can't do it. It takes the Master Potter to actually do the job. We can't do that. And this is something that Job didn't get. He reckoned he was righteous, he was doing the right things, and all his friends were the same way. You're righteous, doing the right things, but oh yes, but you've got to be doing something wrong. There's some box you aren't ticking. And chapter after chapter after chapter, it goes on, trying to find the box that he's not ticking. when really it was a much more fundamental problem. That fundamental problem was that the relationship wasn't accurate. The relationship wasn't accurate because it was centered on Job. The righteousness that he was doing was centered on him. It was for his benefit. And that's not the case. He was being worked with by God to be converted into a son, a living son of God. And if all he had was his own righteousness, he would never, ever fulfill that potential. Because the difference between him and that his righteousness and the righteousness of God was huge. Vast, beyond huge. It was like saying to a child in the womb, you know, take that kettle and put it on the stove. Totally impossible.
Utterly impossible. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. To the Jews a stumbling block, and to the Greeks foolishness. But unto those that are being called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. So the power and the wisdom that's necessary is given to us. It's done through the very Spirit of God.
It's not just waving a magic wand and saying, ah, yes, you're righteous. That's not just by the sacrifice of Christ. The sacrifice of Christ covers sins that are past. And having those sins covered, we have access to God the Father. We are then able to gain access to the Spirit of God. And it's through that Spirit, having our minds converted, changed, that allows us to become, to take on the character of God. The nature of God, what God is, until eventually we can be born into the family of God.
Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, how there are not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things that are mighty. And base things of the world, and the things that are despised as God chosen, yet, and things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence, including Job.
The righteousness of Job didn't cut it, because it was based on self, purely on self. It wasn't based on God's righteousness. The relationship wasn't accurate, his focus was on himself. And until he actually said, behold, I'm vile. I'm vile. Because compared to this being, where were you when you laid the foundation of the earth? Declare if you have knowledge. You explain the slit experiment. When a piece of matter goes through and behaves as a wave until you watch it. And then it behaves as a particle. How? What is it? What is this stuff that we're in? Explain. I can't. Neither could Job. But God can. Christ made it.
And what does he require of us? Well, put in your notes Micah 6:8, to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. To walk. Now, Job did justly. Job loved mercy.
But Job was not walking humbly with God. That was the problem. He wasn't walking humbly with God. He was doing it for his own reasons, for his own purpose. He was doing the justly part was right. He was loving mercy, he was inviting people into his house, he was doing what was right. But it was all because of Job's righteousness, so that Job could be counted righteous.
Turn over to Psalm 39. And it is that huge difference between the Creator and ourselves that doesn't just illustrate the fact that we are clay and being worked on by this incredible being, but there's the other aspect. That the reason why he's working on us is to make us into an incredible being as well. We can't do that ourselves. Impossible. That's why to be plugged into the vine, to maintain that relationship with God, and to be malleable and
willing to be changed in his hands. That's the only thing we can do. Allow the DNA, allow this book, including the book of Job, to define what we, how we actually are to be behaving. But here in Psalm 39, notice in verse 4, Lord, eternal, make me know my end and the measure of my days, what it is that I may know how frail I am. This is David speaking. Behold, you've made my days as a handbreadth, and my age is as nothing before you. Truly, every man in his very best state is altogether vanity. Selah, think about that. Stop and just pause. In his very best state, doesn't matter how good or righteous we are, and our very best state is nothing. Absolutely nothing in comparison with this being. Surely every man walks in a vain show, in an image of himself. His mind centered on himself. Surely they are disquieted in vain. He heaps up riches and doesn't know who shall gather them. And now, Lord, what am I waiting for? My hope is in you. And that's the key area, that our hope is in God. Our hope is in God to change us. He's the master potter. But the vast difference between the clay and the master potter isn't the only vast difference. It's between the clay and what the clay has got to become. That's the difference. That's the difference. And when we start thinking about that, you know, it blows the mind. And that's why we can't do it. We cannot convert ourselves into a God being, which is just impossible. But we can go to the Father, we can repent, or we can take hold of the sacrifice of Christ, go to the Father, ask for his Holy Spirit, so that we can be led by that Spirit, and allow him, through all the trials of life, to mould us, to convert us, to change us into his likeness. Into his likeness. That's what it's all about. Turn over to Matthew chapter 28. Matthew chapter 28. Right at the end of Matthew. And remember, Christ, here, just before he left this earth, he said, then the 11 disciples, verse 16, Matthew chapter 28, went away to Galilee to a mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. So here was Christ in a resurrected state. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all power has been given to me in heaven and in earth. He had been given back the power that he had with the Father before he actually divested himself of that power. Go you therefore and teach all nations. Because all power has been given to him, he says, you go and you teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things, whatever I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So right now, Christ hasn't gone off and left his church. The church is shattered. But Christ hasn't gone off and left the church. We can still go back and still hold on to the truth that he gave, recognizing where that truth came from, and recognizing that when you leave that truth, and it is the truth that gets left, it is an apostasy. It is leaving the truth that is so crucial. Where did that truth come from? The reason why existence, why we exist. It didn't come from Mr. Herbert Armstrong. It came through him, but it didn't come from him. And if we turn over to John chapter 14. John chapter 14. It says, verse 15, if you love me, keep my commandments, and I will pray the Father, and he'll give you another comforter, that he may abide with you forever, even the Spirit of truth, that the world cannot receive because it doesn't see it, neither knows it, but you know it, for it dwells with you, and it shall be in you, and I will not leave you. Through that Spirit, Christ, you know, who says all power has been given to us in heaven and earth, Christ doesn't leave us. I will not leave you comfortless. I will come to you. So the power is being given to us through the Holy Spirit. And this living Christ, the living Christ who is the high priest of the church, doesn't leave us. He works with us, each on an individual basis. He is the creator. He is the master potter. He's the one who creates, and he's continuing to create within his church. It's the creator and us in the church. It's this difference between what... it's not just this difference, I said, between the clay and the potter. It's between the clay and what the potter wants the clay to become, which is like him. The same being, the same kind of being as he is. And verse 21. He that has my commandments and keeps them, he it is that loves me. And he that loves me shall be loved of my Father, and I will love him and will manifest myself to him. And Judas said to him, not Iscariot, Lord, how is it that you will manifest yourself to us and not to the world? And Jesus answered and said to him, if a man love me, he will keep my words. And my Father will love him, and we will come unto him, and will make our abode with him. Job had to learn this. The relationship had to be accurate. Because it wasn't just the accuracy of the relationship there and then. It was the relationship had to be accurate for Job to understand what he had to become. And how malleable he had to be in God's hand. We will come unto him, notice. And we will make our abode with him. He that loves me not does not keep my sayings, and the word which you hear is not mine, but the Father who has sent me. Both the Father and Christ are involved in the process, in this creative process. These things I've spoken with you, being yet present with you, but the Comforter, the Parakletos, which is the Holy Spirit that the Father will send in my name, he'll teach you all things and bring all things to your remembrance, whatever I've said to you. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. You've heard how I said to you that I go away and come again to you. If you love me, you'll rejoice, because I said I go to my Father. For my Father is greater than I. Now, it was the one who was the Logos that dealt with Job. The one who was the Logos got this point across with Job. Yet here we are actually dealing with one above the Logos. We actually get on our knees each day to the one above Christ, higher than Christ. How much more does all of the things that happened to Job and what Christ demanded of Job and said that he had to answer him, how much more does that apply to each and every one of us who are dealing with this being? But it's not just dealing with the being. It is that he wants us to become like him. To be converted, to be the same kind, of the same kind as him. The same love, the love of God shed abroad in our heart. His love. That is what was needed. His mindset. His thinking. So that his power can then be given to us in the future when our minds are fully converted. When our bodies are fully converted, when we are fully converted. But you see, God's way, God's mindset is huge. We lose sight of that in the church many times. Here, in this little group here, we just simply lose sight of it. Now, I'm not going to have time to turn to these scriptures, but if you want to take them and put them in your notes. Isaiah 59, verse 20. In fact, go on right the way through to Isaiah 60, verse 3. The Redeemer shall come to Zion, and therefore Zion is going to be ready. How is Zion going to be ready? Where is the church now? The church is shattered. How is the church going to come together again? All I know it is. How is it going to be? I have no idea, but I know the individual who will do it. He will cause that church, the shattered church, to come together again. Because when the church flees, it'll flee as it appears as a single body that flees. And it is the remnant that is left behind. Now, I can't answer all the questions as to how that all fits together, how this will actually take place, but it's going to happen. Isaiah 66, verse 8. Before Zion travailed, the children were born. Zion is going to have to be there. Zion is going to have to be there. Isaiah 52, verse 7 to 8.
Well, how they'll see eye to eye when the Eternal brings Zion. When the Eternal brings Zion. Zion is going to have to be there. And Psalm 102, verse 11 to 16. But let's read that one. Psalm 102. Because something is going to happen. What exactly it is, I don't know. Well, I know that the two witnesses have got to arise. But we don't have to worry, we don't have to fret, because the one that is dealing with us, the high priest that is over the church, is the same one that was dealing with Job. We've got to understand the difference between the clay and the potter. But we've also got to understand the difference between the clay and what the potter wants the clay to become, which is a being the same as him. The same as him. Here in Psalm 102, verse 11, it says, "My days are a shadow that declines. I'm like withered like grass. But you, O Eternal, shall endure forever." Here's the contrast between the potter and the clay. "And your remembrance to all generations. You shall arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favour her." Yes, the set time is come. "For your servants take pleasure in her stones and favour even the dust thereof," the small ones within the church. "So that the nations shall fear the name of the Eternal, and all the kings of the earth your glory. And when the Eternal shall build up Zion, then he shall appear in his glory." That will be the case. That when Zion is built, when it's ready, then he'll appear. Christ will come. And verse 25, "Of old you have laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They shall perish, but you shall endure. All of them will wax old as a garment, and the vesture you'll change them, and they shall be changed." The entirety of the heavens are going to be changed to a spiritual form of some description. "But you are the same, and your years shall have no end." The Eternal is his name, and the eternal by name, and eternal by nature. And but they will notice what he also says, "The children of your servants shall continue, and their seed shall be established before you," and the inference is forever. So that we also, as the children of God, will be able to be there. Because God's way is big, God's mindset is big, it's beyond our mindset completely. But it's also the fact that the Zion is going to be ready. Zion will be ready, and God is the one that will do it, because it's God's work, it's God's truth, it's God's plan, it's God's church. And God will do it. We don't have to fret. We don't have to worry about it. And because God is the creator, the one that we notice in Job. Final scripture, Psalm 138. Psalm 138. "I'll praise you with my whole heart. Before the gods will I sing praise to you, and I'll worship before your holy temple and praise your name for all your loving kindness and for your truth." And the truth is what we really need to hang on to. And apostasy is away from the truth. It's not just away from the belief in God. It's with those that had the truth that apostatized against away from it. "For you have magnified your word above all your name," even your authority, because your word is this word that we have here, this DNA, this spiritual DNA. "In the day when I cry, you answer me, and strengthen me with the strength of my soul. All the kings of the earth shall praise you, O Eternal, when they hear the words of your mouth." And eventually that will be the case. All the kings of the earth, and the entire earth brought under the authority of God. "Yes, they'll sing in the ways of the Eternal, for great is the glory of the Eternal." Where's the focus? The focus is, what David has here, is completely on God. "Though the Eternal be high, yet he has respect to the lowly. But the proud he knows afar off." He makes the distinction. You know, nobody, you know, to do justly, to love mercy, but also to walk humbly with your God. That is necessary. "The proud he knows afar off. Though I walk in the midst of trouble, yet you will revive me. You will stretch forth your hand against the wrath of my enemies, and your right hand shall save me. And the Eternal will perfect that which concerns me." He will perfect. He will do what is necessary to make us righteous.
He will put us through the trials, he'll put us through the problems, he'll allow us to be tested. But he's also never leaves us, he never forsakes us. Because the Master Potter is not just concerned about the relationship between him and the clay, is keeping that relationship accurate. It's between the clay and what the clay has got to be. That has got to be accurate as well.
The Eternal will perfect that which concerns me. Your mercy, O Eternal, endures forever. Do not forsake the work of your own hands.